knowing what you look like and knowing what parts of you are things you need to keep an eye on, that's the first place to start with health literacy, I think, is knowing yourself, knowing your body and your anatomy, and then kind of going from there, like understanding the menstrual cycle and understanding what it means when your period is late, or like what it means to be ovulating in the context of trying to prevent pregnancy. That all comes back to health literacy and understanding about these things about yourself and about the way your body works.
Hi, I'm Deanna Robbins.
And I'm Christy North. Welcome to Pieces of a Woman podcast, where we explore all the pieces that make up a woman, mind, body, and soul.
By embracing all complexities of being a woman, our goal is to share real stories that inspire growth and empower all women to be the best versions of themselves. And as Maya Angelou so eloquently said, when we know better, we do better.
Thank you for taking this journey with us.
It's Christy
and Deanna
with Pieces of a Woman podcast.
Welcome, everyone. We have missed you. We've had a little bit of a, what do you call it, vacation?
Just a few little months. Bit.
I wouldn't say it's a vacation. I would say it's a busy schedule that we just haven't had a chance to record. But we're so excited to be back today. And we actually have a really special guest with us today. So do you want to just jump in? Should we just jump in? You ready?
Let's do it.
Okay. Well, I'm excited because not only do we have Mary Scott Bug here, who is a women's health nurse practitioner. She's also my niece. She's originally from Kentucky.
So we put her on the spot. So we're like, all right, you're coming in town. We're recording.
I'm ready.
Put her on the spot. So she's originally from Kentucky, but she is living and working out of California now. And we're going to let her introduce herself a little bit and talk about her background, and then we're going to dive into all things women's health.
Yeah. I'm really excited to be here. Thanks. This is so fun. So, my name is Mary Scott, and so I'm a women's health nurse practitioner, which for kind of a confusing title. A lot of people know what a midwife is, and so a women's health nurse practitioner is very similar to a midwife, except that we don't do labor and delivery. So we specialize in all outpatient obstetrics, gynecology, and sexual and reproductive health for both men and women, which is confusing because we're women's health nurse practitioners, but we can see men sometimes too. So born and raised in Kentucky, and then I did my undergraduate and my graduate studies at Vanderbilt in Nashville. And I live currently in the Bay Area, so right outside San Francisco, and I've been there for about 3.5 years. Started my first job out of school was actually at Center College, where Deanna's husband Scott went to college, working in their student health center during COVID. Doing COVID triage treatment. And then I started to do a little bit of gynecology with the college students there. And then in November of 2020, I moved to the Bay Area where I live now and started working for Planned Parenthood. I was there for about 3 years. And then in December of 2023, I left that job. And as of February of this year, I'm currently working at the University of California at San Francisco in their obstetrics outpatient team. So I'm an obstetrics NP or an OB-NP. And so my current role is doing all things prenatal care and postpartum care. So very, very different from my last role, but I'm really excited and so far really enjoying it. So I've been there for about a month.
So basically, she has a shit ton of knowledge on women's health.
So for us, everything that we do in terms of our podcast, we love to focus on women, obviously. So why would we not have a medical piece where we can kind of explore all the areas from young women to, what do we call ourselves today? Not older, gracefully aging, I don't know, something like that. So I do want to touch on young women's healthcare, because you kind of mentioned earlier that I think you said you had done some work in the young women's.
Yes. Yes. So when I worked at Planned Parenthood, we typically saw patients of all ages. So we could see people as young as as early as when they get their period. So, you know, that could be as early as 9, 10, which I didn't see any people that young. But I had a lot of patients who were in their early teens. So I saw 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds. And then all the way up to people who were postmenopausal, we saw. But most of my patients at that role were people in their teens, 20s, and for like contraception, STD testing, things like that. And then I did see a good amount of people, like women in their 40s, 50s, 60s for cancer screening, because in California, there's a great cancer prevention program where women who don't qualify for other state funding programs, so they don't qualify for Medi-Cal or Medicaid, and they don't have insurance, they can be a part of this program, and they have access to breast cancer screening and cervical cancer screening services. And then those can also lead to treatment. So I did a lot of work in that space as well. So most of my patients, I would say, were younger, but I did do also probably at least 30-40% of like cancer screening visits at that job.
Wow. Planned Parenthood, amazing. Because I always just looked at Planned Parenthood when I think of my teenage years. We went there for birth control.
Yeah. And very different.
Yeah. And today it's, or...
Yeah. I think that's a really common misconception about Planned Parenthood, especially the way that it's talked about in the media, is, you know, it's seen as this huge controversial place. But really what Planned Parenthood does is, in most states, it's birth control, it's cancer prevention, it's STD testing and treatment.
Yeah.
The more controversial pieces do exist in many, many states, and including in California where I worked. However, that's not the majority of what they do.
Yeah.
And it's a really good space for people like women who don't have insurance to be able to go and get the services they couldn't get otherwise. Yeah. So they do a lot of prevention, treatment, and screening. And that's kind of the piece I think is not talked about when it comes to Planned Parenthood. So.
No, I think that's great, but you said something that kind of shocked me. So you see patients that are young, or you did, that were as young as 12, 13, 14. Now, why would they come in at that age just because they've started their period?
So a lot of times, mostly to get on birth control.
At that young of an age?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Are they sexually active?
Most of the time, yeah.
At 12, 13, and 14?
I've seen it. I've seen it often. Put in... arm implant. So there's a birth control called a Nexplanon. It's an arm implant.
Okay.
I've put arm implants in people as young as 12 because they were thinking about becoming sexually active.
And I think it's amazing considering where else would they go? And if they don't have anybody that is helping them navigate that, the fact that you can go into a place and get support there, I think is a beautiful thing. And the fact that at 12, if you're going to have sex, you're being mindful of prevention.
And what was great, and I think this isn't how it is in all states, but in, and you know, people have different opinions on this, but in California, sexual and reproductive health is considered a confidential service.
Mm-hmm.
So 12, 13-year-olds, obviously we would hope that they would be in a safe space with their family, that they could talk about their healthcare needs, but a lot of times they're not. So they can come to any healthcare facility that they can access, and that those services can be kept confidential.
Yeah.
So if a 12-year-old is, you know, oh, I'm thinking of being sexually active, but I don't want my parents to know, and I don't want to get pregnant, they can still access those services without involving their consent from their parents.
Wow.
Yeah. Which is...
Do you remember the episode we did on the trafficking?
Yeah.
And the young women, young girls that were in that environment, and they had the ability to go into Planned Parenthood for the STD testing, but also birth control.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Well, and at the time, they weren't getting birth control because who we interviewed, unfortunately, she was sent to have an abortion at 12.
Yeah.
And all I guess what I'm saying is I think it's so great, but at the same time, I'm just a little shocked. You know, this is my age. I'm just like, at 12, you're so young.
Yeah.
You know?
You're a kid yourself.
You're so young. And so anyway, was the reason for my response, but I think
it is shocking, and it should be shocking. And and I think a lot of that, like, you know, when people are so young, you don't have the literal brain development to foresee what the long-term consequences of your actions can be. And if you're not taught, you know, because we had a lot of my patient population was like raised Catholic. Yeah. And so there, in a lot of these places, a lot of these relationships, it's like sexual education wasn't spoken about because it was considered like culturally taboo.
Yeah.
And so, but that doesn't stop people, as we know, not talking about it doesn't stop people from having sex. It doesn't stop people from making, you know, these choices that could affect them in the long run. And so, and sex ed is also failing. And because there's a lot of thought that if we're talking about it, it's going to happen more often.
Yeah.
What we actually know is that if you're having sex ed where you're talking about what it means, because I mean, how many people at 12 years old really understand what it means to be able to get pregnant and what that ramification can be? And if we're not talking about and talking about the consequences, then we actually have really good research that supports that sex ed is decreasing rates of teenage pregnancy because it's the information is being given. So it is really shocking.
Yeah.
And I put IUDs in 15-year-olds.
Yeah.
Which, but there were people who didn't feel comfortable putting in IUDs in people so young, but I was like, that's the birth control they want. And if it works.
Yeah.
So that was really shocking.
Yeah. So now talking about birth control. So what are the new, Chrissy and I are obviously out of the arena of birth control, yeah. have been for a little while. Yeah. What are the newest, most effective ways of birth control that you're seeing and you're prescribing, and what are you seeing now?
Birth control pill is still really popular. Okay. A lot of people are uncomfortable with the idea of getting something put into their body, like a Nexplanon or an IUD. Nexplanon, like I said, is the arm implant. But we're seeing a rise in arm implants and IUDs.
Okay.
They are the most effective at preventing pregnancy. So we call them LARCs, long-acting reversible contraceptives.
Oh, okay.
And that's the IUD. Yeah, the IUDs, the Nexplanons. So those right now, actually, a Mirena IUD, which is a hormonal IUD, and a Nexplanon are considered as, if not more effective than a tubal ligation. So having your tubes tied.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So we are really encouraging of people to get those because a lot of times they also have less systemic side effects, but they also last forever. So they say it's like a one and done. You get it put in, you don't think about it for years. But obviously, not everybody is comfortable with that too. But I think we are seeing a big increase in IUDs, Nexplanons. But most people are still on the birth control pill.
So if you get those removed, how long, like if you get married or whatever, you decide you're going to have children, how long does it have to be removed to then be able to conceive?
I tell my patients you can get pregnant that night.
Oh, you can.
Instantly. Mm-hmm. And I can speak to that.
Oh. Yeah.
I can completely speak to that. When Kenny and I decided to have Kennedy, I had an IUD and had it removed and immediately
really?
We were pregnant. It's interesting because I have an IUD currently and my hormone doctor has basically kind of suggested that I keep it in until a certain period of time.
Yeah.
And then once we have tested for the estrogen levels, then we will remove it. But I've had it in for probably, I don't know, 7 years.
Yeah. Do you have the Mirena? Mm-hmm. If you're, yeah. So yeah. That, I totally agree. Mirena's great. I have Mirena too. So
yeah, I love it. And I recommended to my daughter, who's now 22, to get one. And she had a little bit more complications with it, but she did appreciate the fact that she didn't have to worry about taking a pill. She didn't have to remember what she was doing. It was stress free for her. But she was one of those that didn't like the idea of something in her body.
Yeah, which I think is really understandable.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only birth control method that we know can delay your fertility. So no birth control decreases your fertility. So no birth control makes you less fertile. But the Depo-Provera shot, which I'm sure you all know of, that is the only birth control we know can delay your fertility. So when it's for 3 months, it stays in your system. And after the end of the 3 months, it can take up to 10 months for your fertility to resume. But it doesn't make you less fertile. It just takes longer for it to come back. So
that makes sense.
So those are great questions for somebody who's considering birth control, like depending on where they're at in their life to ask those questions.
Or if you have teenage girls that maybe they're at that age where you're worried if they're going to be sexually active and they're asking about it.
Yeah absolutely.
For sure. Yeah. So talking about the younger, teenagers, early 20s, what is the best advice you would give them as far as taking care of themselves and their bodies and just their overall care?
Are you talking about sexual health or hygiene or both?
I think both. Good advice because sometimes you don't know what you don't know.
Yes.
And so what are things that they should really be taking care of that they maybe haven't thought of?
So one thing that I think is the most, especially when it comes to sexuality and young people, is that I think to really understand what consent is and how, because I think especially younger girls and anybody, it's so much more easy to be coerced into situations that they may not actually feel ready or comfortable with. And so I think really understanding what it means to really say yes to being intimate with somebody, that is kind of I think a mental sexual health perspective, because I think especially, and not always, but when you're young, sexuality is so tied to your mental well-being. And even throughout people's whole lives, it can be, but especially when people are young, it can be, people think of it as something that is tied to their value, which it may, it's not. But that's one thing I always like to tell people about is if you're thinking about becoming sexually active, really think about what that means to you.
Yeah.
As far as health and hygiene goes, I say don't buy anything scented ever for female hygiene.
Okay.
That's one thing I think is people are so concerned about smells and odors. And so people are using scented products like scented pads, scented washes, douches, all those things, which really increase your risk of infection, which then cause a true odor.
Yeah.
And so, and I think there's a lot of paranoia about, like, when you hear, like, the things that are, when, that they talk about in music, like, in rap songs, when they're referencing, like, women's vaginas. And and the language they use and the way they talk about it, I'm like, this is not true. It's not fair. Nothing is supposed to smell like roses and sunshine. But, but just knowing the difference between, like, what's normal and what's not normal.
Yeah.
And talking about things, like, to, especially to young women, like, talking about discharge, I think it's something that is so many young girls all the time were so disgusted by their own bodies because of these things they hear from the boys in class that they heard from the older brothers or things they hear in rap music or not just rap music, but like any music where people are talking about women's bodies. And so talking about what is normal and what is not normal. And honestly, at the end of the day, just like knowing your body too. I think so many young girls are afraid to know what they look like. And if you don't know what your normal is, how are you really going to know when something is abnormal?
Yeah.
So does that kind of answer your question?
Yes. So beautiful.
Yeah.
And I have so many thoughts on that.
Yeah.
Because one, my mind went a few different areas. One, is douching necessary?
Mm-mm. No. And I actually highly advise against it.
Okay.
So douching, so inside the vagina, you have healthy bacteria called lactobacilli. And their job is to keep the vagina a low pH. A pH of 4.5 is ideal, but even up to 5 can be considered normal, which is not something you would ever check. Like, you don't need to know that about yourself. But, and these bacteria, you know, that's why you have, like, normal discharge. Because these bacteria are, they allow the vagina to be a self-cleaning oven. And so they take the normal, like, secretions of the vaginal wall and they keep the bad bacteria at bay by keeping the pH of the vagina low.
Okay.
And so when people douche or put water inside or soap inside, even if it's just fingers inside the vagina to clean, you can literally remove that barrier, remove those healthy bacteria, and then pathogenic bacteria, like the bacteria that can cause bacterial vaginosis, which is like the fishy odor infection that you can get, yeast infections. And so the only thing I say that you really, I mean, you can just use water on the outside too. But if you wanted to use soap on where you grow hair, that is appropriate at times because you have similar glands on the vulva where the hair grows that you do to your armpit. And so like a body odor type smell is actually normal in the vulva because of those glands. But if you wanted to use like a gentle non-scented soap where you grow hair, that is safe for the vulva if it's unscented. But anything inside like douching, I highly recommend against. And it can actually increase your risk of STDs too. Because
you don't have the protection.
Exactly. You don't have those good bacteria that help, that can kind of help your natural immunity fight off if you come into contact with those other pathogens. So that's my thoughts on douching.
Okay, so first of all, I'm loving where our conversation is going. I had no idea we were going to talk about the vagina, but I'm so glad we have.
We all have one.
I wanted to go back a little bit because we were talking about birth control and there's questions regarding the rhythm method.
Yes, I'm happy to talk about
that. I would love to talk about it because, I mean, I know there's religious reasons why people do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to be sensitive to what people believe, but the reality is, how effective is it?
That's a really good question. And so to talk about the rhythm method, we have to acknowledge that the rhythm method is effective in people who have regular menstrual cycles and who have the energy, the resources to be able to monitor their fertility, which is actually quite costly to do it effectively. And I can go into all the ways that we do this, but to monitor your fertility effectively, it requires time, it requires space, and it requires supplies. And it also requires your body to be on a normal menstrual cycle. So a normal menstrual cycle, we say, is if you're having a monthly period, this is in the absence of birth control, every 25 to 32 days, which is not the majority of people. And it has to be consistently every 25 to 32 days. If you're having a regular cycle like that, then, and you're not having any abnormalities in your cycle, you are a good candidate for natural family planning, so the rhythm method. But so many things can affect our periods that can delay them, that's not pregnancy. The number one agent that can delay a period other than pregnancy is stress.
Oh, okay.
So a lot of people will say, I miss my period and I'm not pregnant. What's wrong with me? And I was like, well, what's new in your life? Like, did you change jobs? Did you move? You know, did you just break up with your boyfriend and are really like, and all those things can cause a menstrual delay.
Okay.
So that's where we have to start with the rhythm method is you have to already have this biologic normal menstrual cycle that so many people
like so many people have irregular periods. Then, you, like I was saying, you have to have the time and ability to monitor your fertility. So the best way, there are a couple different ways you can do this. The first thing that we do is called basal body temperature tracking. So your basal body temperature is what your internal temperature is with at complete rest.
Okay.
So without, because the second that you get up and you're moving, your body temperature increases. And so, and you know, you both have kids, so I want you to imagine this. You wake up and the very first thing you do is you have to take your temperature before you move. How easy is that when you already have kids at home?
Right.
To immediately, first thing you do when you take it, you have to have your thermometer at your bedside, can't even roll over, put your, you take your temperature, write it down. Immediately. Oh,
wow. Yeah.
Like it's so difficult
to
do. It's so difficult to do when you don't have kids.
Yeah.
Imagine if you already have kids. So that's the first thing that you have to do in order to accurately track your cycles to make sure that you're not having intercourse in this fertile window to prevent pregnancy. The other thing you can do is check your luteinizing hormone, which is basically you have to test your urine every day to see when you're ovulating. So yeah, so that's checking your urine. I think they generally recommend the first urine of the day. You take a little test to see where your luteinizing hormone is because you will see it change when you're closer to your ovulatory window.
Okay.
So you have to do that too. In order to like really make this rhythm method effective, you have to do both those things. Basal body temperature tracking, checking your luteinizing hormone in your urine. You can also check things like your cervical mucus. So you put a finger inside the vagina, feel for the mucus, and you look at it. You write it down. What does it look like?
Does really people do that? Mm-hmm. Like this is like overwhelming to me.
I know.
It seems like a lot of work versus taking a pill or putting an IUD in. But I guess if you're against taking something.
Right.
But I love the emphasis on you have to be so committed and so disciplined with the process of it for it to be effective.
Exactly. And so if you're doing all those things before it is effective, though, you have to do it for 6 months because you have to have 6 months of data in order to actually get the average of when you're ovulating. So most people, and it's also, we calculate when you ovulate, we go backwards. So from your period. So you can only go backwards in time if you have all this data to look at.
Yeah.
So the average person who has a regular monthly menstrual cycle is ovulating 14 days before the first day of their period.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we can talk about the all the different parts of the menstrual cycle, but the way when we talk about fertility tracking, we kind of look at it in two different phases, the follicular phase and the luteal phase.
Yeah.
Luteal phase is almost always 14 days. So that's from when you ovulate to when you start your period. So that is what is most consistent. The follicular phase, which is the first half from when your period starts to when you ovulate, can vary a lot by person. So that's why some people have different like length of cycles. But so you have to have 6 months of data before you can even reliably use it.
Hmm.
And so if people are like, oh, I want to start using this today, then it's...
Chances are you might
get
pregnant.
You need to understand, you need to have a really good understanding of your menstrual cycle in order for it to be effective. So 6 months of data before you can have unprotected intercourse in your non-fertile window.
Well, what's interesting though is you say that you need to have a really good understanding of your menstrual cycle and all of the things that you just talked through in a 6 month window, and so much changes.
Mm-hmm.
You might have all this great data in 6 months, but then your life completely changes over the rest of it. And it could be that you decided to be an athlete or take up running and cause stress to your body. It's not necessarily another type of stress. It's something physically that's affecting the way your body moves. So
you're exactly right.
I would say that may not be the most effective way to
Right. And so the other thing that we know is that, so it's not just avoiding intercourse on the day you ovulate. So when you ovulate, the egg lives for 24 hours. So in theory, you ovulate and then you are fertile the 24 hours after you ovulate.
Okay.
But sperm can live inside the vagina and in the uterus for 5 to 7 days.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So you have to avoid intercourse for the 5 to 7 days before you ovulate and the day after you ovulate.
Oh, those little buggers just like to hang out in there.
They love just to hang out.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So that's essentially 10 days a month.
Okay. Yeah.
Where if you're trying to do this accurately, you can't be having unprotected intercourse.
Okay.
And the pull-out method does not count as
unprotected
intercourse because it doesn't work. So,
that doesn't work.
So I think that the rhythm method is really great for people who, first of all, have the body to have regular monthly menstrual cycles without major life changes and are able to really accurately monitor their fertility, which, like I said, it takes a lot.
Yeah.
And putting it into your phone app is not enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for the clarification on that. So
that's what I see a lot. Is a lot of people are like, well, but I, you know, I was putting it in my phone and I didn't have sex in my fertile window because my phone said I shouldn't. And I said, well, have you actually been actually checking in with your body with basal body temperature tracking and, you know, checking your ovulation kit tests, the luteinizing hormone tests? Yeah. Like, no, I just did it on my phone. I'm like, well, your phone is only guessing when you're ovulating based off when your period is. And there are so many other factors. Mm-hmm. And if you're not actually taking this data and to avoid pregnancy, like finding out when you are actually ovulating, your phone's not a reliable enough method.
Definitely.
Oh my gosh. Well, okay. So far, the one thing I love that you keep saying too is I love your connection between mental health and your body.
Yeah.
And the connection between that and just being, and the good thing is we have options. Like women have options.
Yeah.
And so that's the beautiful thing. But I've learned a lot. I'm like 57 going, shit, I just learned something new.
I had no idea the rhythm method, that there was so much work.
Oh, me neither. But it's good to understand all of that. Okay, so curious before we move on to like older, just curious, what do the younger generation, we have another friend who's a nurse who works in, she does clinical trials and mm-hmm. she works a lot with STDs, etc. Mm-hmm. And what are the STDs that people need to worry about right now? What are you seeing? Is there more coming, happening now than another, or what's more?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So a lot of it is surprisingly region specific. So I can really only speak to California.
Okay.
But in general, we're seeing everybody gets chlamydia. So chlamydia is the most common STD.
Okay.
Also, I may sometimes say STI. They're interchangeable. It's just people use different vernacular, STI versus STD. It's the same thing, though.
Okay.
So chlamydia is most common, has been since, you know, since we started testing for STDs. But what we're seeing a rise in is syphilis.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So on the West Coast, so California, Washington, and Oregon, we are seeing a drastic increase in congenital syphilis. So it's babies being born with syphilis.
Really?
To now, where, so like I said, I work in obstetrics now. So California Public Health Department is requiring pregnant women to get tested for syphilis at their first prenatal visit and in the third trimester. Even if you have no risk factors for contracting syphilis.
Uh-huh.
Because it is so detrimental to babies and if they're born with it. So huge increase in syphilis.
Why?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think that it's so, as we talk more about STDs, a lot of people think it's as easy as just doing a urine test, which is true, except syphilis is bloodborne. So you can get it through intercourse, you can get it through sharing needles. And so I'm wondering, and a lot of people though are averse to having their blood drawn. I saw that a lot in my last job, where people are like, oh, I'm happy to do the urine test, but I don't want my blood drawn for a testing. And if you don't have symptoms of syphilis, which most people don't, same with any STD, most people have no symptoms. The number one symptom of an STD is no symptom at all.
Really?
Which is why routine screening is important, which I can also go into that too. But
So
I think that has something to do with it. But I also think we do see these trends in public health diseases, and we don't know necessarily why we're seeing this increase. But yeah, so those are, chlamydia has always been around, it's always been an issue, but we really are seeing a rise in syphilis.
I mean, and what can prevent that? Because I think taking ownership, it's part of the mental health piece.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and I can only speak for myself, but I think sometimes, especially when I was younger, you can be very trusting.
Yes.
Like, oh, he said he's not really been with anyone or whatever. And I feel like people are, they're not going to be truthful, but also what should you, I mean, is it just having protected sex, using a condom? Hands down, just make that choice if you want to be protected.
It is.
Okay.
So, and I think kind of this circles back a bit to what we were talking about earlier of how I educate young people about sexual health and about their bodies. And is that, you know, is condom use, because until you're monogamous with somebody and you're both have been tested in a relationship, you shouldn't be having unprotected sex no matter how much you trust this person. Because if you don't have the test results to prove that they don't have any STIs, and STIs, thankfully, most of them are so easily treated. Like I always say, you know, chlamydia is so common, it's like strep throat of the vagina. Yeah. It's easy to treat, but if you don't treat it, it can have long-term damage. Yeah. But it's not any more serious than a strep throat infection is. Just the fact that it's passive and intimate nature, I think, makes it so taboo. But yes, so condom use is the only way that we... Well, that's actually not true. So condom use is the number one way that we can prevent STIs. There are some new medications coming up. There is one medication, or there are two medications that we call PrEP. So it's called pre-exposure prophylaxis, and that's for HIV specifically.
Okay.
So if you're a demographic who is at risk for HIV, I always recommend being on PrEP.
Okay.
They are now coming out with something else called DoxyPep. And so it's an antibiotic called doxycycline. And you take it, and it's very new, and we didn't prescribe it at my last job, so I'm not as familiar with it. But it's this medication that is typically used to treat, it can treat syphilis and it can treat chlamydia. And you take it around the time of like an active unprotected sex. Okay. I can't remember the exact like duration you take it. And we have seen decreased rates of syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia by in people who are using this DoxyPep method. However, not seen to be as effective in women.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So we see it. So it's being recommended to prescribe a lot in men who have sex with men. Because that demographic, or like trans women, that demographic, we know it's really effective at preventing STDs.
Okay.
But in people with vaginas, uteruses, women, we generally are seeing it's not as effective. We don't know why. But also that research wasn't done in the United States, so I don't know if that has something to do with it. So I think we'll see more about that coming out as a way that if condom use is non-negotiable with your partner, which in my opinion, if you can't negotiate your safety with the partner, you shouldn't be having sex with them. But, yep. And I also don't think that's the thing a lot of people see it as.
Yeah.
Because STIs can be a safety risk for women in a way they're not as much with men.
Tell me more about that.
Especially chlamydia, but also gonorrhea, they can progress to the uterus and call it something called pelvic inflammatory disease,
okay.
Which if it goes untreated, it can lead to sepsis. Also, though, it can cause scarring of the uterus, so it can decrease your fertility. And in men, if they have STIs, it's not going to cause sepsis, usually. It can, if it goes untreated, also cause scarring of the epididymis, which is like the tube that transports semen. That can also decrease risk of fertility, but it's way less likely in men than it is women. So really, STIs are a safety conversation, not just a, I don't want to wear a condom.
Yeah.
You can trust me. It's a safety conversation. So, but that's kind of what we're seeing right now as far as prevention goes, is these new medications that are up and coming for men, and hopefully we see more for women.
I just finished an episode on The Resident.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of my new favorite shows. And a patient came in with gonorrhea.
Mm-hmm.
And it was her knee. Her knee was inflamed and bruised and injured, and she could not wrap her head around how that would be gonorrhea. And so they went into the details
it's called disseminated gonorrhea.
Okay.
Yeah. So it gets into your bloodstream, and it for some reason affects the joints.
Yes.
It can affect your eyes too.
Yes.
What the hell?
So yeah, I don't know when we started doing this, but now babies, most of them, and you can always say no, but when babies are born, they get a little eye cream put in their eyes to prevent ocular gonorrhea.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what that's for.
But my naiveness and my age, I did not know that.
It's so rare. It's really, really rare. But it does happen. I've thankfully never seen it. I've never seen either ocular or like joint gonorrhea, but it does happen.
Wow.
Which is wild.
That's fascinating.
Learning at 57. So when I was, when my kids were teenagers, my boys, I actually think I did have my girls do it. When I thought that they were going to start being active sexually, I had them write a report on STDs.
I love that. That's awesome.
Of course you did.
And I had to each write a full-on report on every STD and what to do.
That's awesome.
That's really awesome.
So.
Another thing that I feel passionately about, too, is the HPV shot. Gardasil. It's given to we can now give it to both boys and girls. Usually it used to just be given to girls.
Yeah.
But men, people with penises, are the vectors of HPV, which is the virus that can cause cervical cancer. And so we've started even offering it to people who didn't have it when they were young but are now older. So that's another way you can prevent HPV. So it can really decrease your risk of cervical cancer, which is awesome.
Yeah, that is so
By 90%.
Wow, that's huge.
Yeah, so that's another thing too.
Well, I feel like we're learning so much and we're just like touching the surface.
Yeah.
But like there's so, I just would encourage young women to always ask the question and find somebody to be able to ask the question to.
Absolutely. Like find a reliable person that you can have these conversations with, even if it's, I mean, we always want to encourage people to have these relationships with their parents if they can.
Yeah.
We also know how hard it was. I mean, we were kids, and also, I mean, I don't have kids, but I know you all do. And like those conversations can be hard to have with your kids, I'm sure. And with your parents, even, you know, I'm so lucky that I have parents who are really open and accepting, and I did have these conversations with them growing up. But even then, with my great, wonderful, open, accepting parents, it can always be a little, like, uncomfortable, you know? So also having a trusted source that they can talk to.
And I tell the women that are listening, you know, you may think that your child's talking to you about everything, and I hope that they are, but in the event that they're not, you should probably suggest, if you don't think you can come to me, let's find somebody that you do feel comfortable with to talk to about these things.
But the other component I want to add to it, because I think it adds to the mental health piece is the social media.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And you get, and I feel like so many people are getting misinformation or the pressure for, I mean, we didn't have that pressure growing up, you know, and I think the pressure to have sex when maybe you're really not ready would come into play more now, but also just the misinformation about it. I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
Oh, I think that TikTok is one of the worst things that's happened for birth control.
Really?
Because I actually had to say this earlier, we're talking about what's popular with birth control, but so many people, so especially young, like teenagers, young people in their early 20s, are seeing things on internet, especially things like TikTok, that are so anti-hormonal birth control, and it's all misinformation. Birth control does not decrease fertility. It does not increase your risk of breast cancer. Everything has its risks and its benefits. Everything has side effects. Okay. And do I think that our gold standard of birth control should be to compare it against pregnancy? No. But right now, that's what it is. And everything that can go wrong with birth control, like, you know, weight gain, mood changes, acne, is worse with pregnancy. Especially when it's unintended. So I think that social media is just so much damage because anybody can talk about anything. And I do think that, women who've had bad experiences with birth control, they have a right to speak about their experience because you are the expert of your own body. But I think there's a difference between talking about your experience and saying, this means this is evil and bad. And that's what we're seeing a lot of. Also, you only write a review of a restaurant if you didn't like it, right? So we're not hearing all these great, wonderful stories about people's IUDs. We're only hearing the horror stories of how they passed out because it was so painful and things like that. And so I think we definitely see that with birth control.
Yeah.
A lot. I don't know so much about what it's like with social media and pressuring like teenagers to have sex. I imagine though, especially because actually I think about this, the prominence of, I don't know if it's still happening, but like using things like Snapchat to converse instead of texting, because Snapchat, you know, the messages go away. And so there's no way to hold people accountable.
Yeah.
And so those conversations are happening in this space where you can't, you know, you can't go back and find it. And people can, I think, can probably say things they wouldn't always say if they knew that the screenshots could be pulled up. I mean, you can screenshot Snapchat. That is true. But
But when you're thinking, you got to think twice before you decide to send something, because the other person can screenshot it and have it forever.
Right.
And it's just so damaging. I mean, that's a whole other topic. But
So that's how I feel about social media. Yeah. And I enjoy TikTok just as much as the other.
Yeah.
The next person, but it's hard on birth control.
Yeah. Okay. Now going up the age ladder just a little bit women's health, I have a lot of questions because I feel like in our age group, there's a lot of misinformation because if you go to in gynecology, you get one message and then I think a general practitioner will say a different message for women's health. And so Christy, I want you to jump in here too, but I have a question. So if you get a hysterectomy and you keep your ovaries, do you ever have to have a pap smear again?
No. It depends on, but you need to double check and make sure they didn't leave your cervix. Most people aren't leaving cervixes with a hysterectomy. Okay. Most of the time they're having it removed. There was a while where people thought that leaving the cervix, because like leaving the cervix with a hysterectomy had an effect on sexual satisfaction. The research doesn't support that. Okay. Because also then you have this place that can get cancer easier than other parts. So, but if you've had a hysterectomy, even if you have your ovaries, if you've had a hysterectomy and you've had your cervix removed, which most people with hysterectomies have, then no, you do not need pap smears anymore. No.
You really don't.
So you don't have the cervix, you don't need the pap smear, but you definitely want to get checked periodically for your ovaries, right? So that you have your ovaries checked.
That's tough. So that is a really hard question. So we have no way to screen for ovarian cancer because ovarian cancer tends to be asymptomatic until it's not. So a lot of people have differing opinions on, do you need an annual pelvic exam?
Yes.
So ACOG, which is the Academy or the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, they're kind of like the overseers of everything OBGYN. They have done the research and they have stated that pelvic exams are not needed annually in the absence of cancer screening or symptomatic concerns.
Okay.
So as a provider, I do not do annual pelvic exams. I don't think they're necessary because you're almost looking for problems that you may not need to address. Now, some people feel more comfortable having an annual pelvic exam, and I would never tell somebody no if they're like, I really just want you to take a look inside just to make sure everything looks normal. If that's what somebody wants, absolutely I would do that. Doing that though, an annual pelvic exam is still not screening for ovarian cancer though. So
that's true.
Right. Yeah. So it just adds a level of discomfort. So if you want one every year, for as far as pelvic exams goes, have at it. You don't need one though, unless you're having symptoms or you need a pap smear.
Okay, so when you're younger, how often do they have to have pap smear?
So
it used to be for us, it was like every year you went. Mm-hmm. Now what is it?
So these guidelines change pretty frequently. Okay. So we recommend starting at age 21 every 3 years. Okay. Until age 30, if you have normal tests. Once you turn 30, we do something called co-tests. So when we talk about a pap smear itself, or a like a Papanicolaou smear, is also what we call cytology. So basically, we take a sample of cells off the cervix, send it to a lab. They look at the cells under a microscope, and they say, do these cells look normal? Do they look abnormal? That's what a pap smear is, looking at the cells. And then we also have something called an HPV test,
yeah,
where when they do the pap smear, they look in the fluid, the cervical fluid, for the human papillomavirus that causes cervical cancer. So a lot of things can cause abnormal pap smears, so abnormal cells that are not HPV-based. And HPV is causing 99% of cervical cancer.
Even
if you have an abnormal pap smear, but your HPV test is negative, it likely means that you're not at an increased risk for cervical cancer. So, which is all very confusing and nuanced. And the guidelines change. So, pap smear only age 21 to 30, if they're normal. Now, at age 30, we do the co-test, which is the pap smear, so looking at the cells, and an HPV test. It's every 5 years.
Every 5 years.
Okay. Once you turn 30 and you're getting a co-test.
Okay.
Some places we'll start offering co-tests as early as 25. And we know that HPV is the prime cause of cervical cancer. Okay. And other inflammation processes can cause your cells to be abnormal. So if you don't have HPV, you're probably not going to have cervical cancer, even if your cells look abnormal. So then, though, if you have an abnormal, it changes everything. So it depends on how abnormal it is, because it's graded from like low risk to unknown risk, high risk, to changes concerning for cancer. So that kind of changes things as well.
Yeah.
We don't do pap smears every year anymore because we have really robust research that tells us that if you're doing a pap smear every year, you are increasing the likelihood you're going to find an abnormal pap smear because you're doing them more often, which means that you're more likely to have more invasive procedures, so like a biopsy. We also know that even if you're having more abnormal pap smears by doing it every year and doing these invasive procedures, we don't see a decrease in cervical cancer.
Oh.
So, like, because you would think more surveillance would mean less cancer. We're not seeing that as doing pap smears every 3 to 5 years.
Oh, okay.
So it's less invasive procedures for an equal risk of pap smears. So that's kind of why we do them less often. Then we recommend doing them until age 65. So every 5 years until age 65. And if you're turning 65 and you've had a pap smear in the last 5 years and you've not had an abnormal pap smear for 20 years before that. So if you haven't had an abnormal pap smear from the age 45 to 65, and you turn 65, and you get a pap smear, you don't need one ever again.
Okay. I knew there had to have been an age where you stop. Like,
yes.
So you should, if you have all your parts,
yeah,
still continue to have them.
So that's me. Yep.
That's you.
I should be getting one.
Yeah.
If you haven't had one in 5 years, yes.
I don't recall.
Every 5 years. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So every 5 years until you're 65.
Okay.
And then again, if you've had abnormals, then you keep getting them until you get that 20 years without.
Okay.
But yeah.
So that's really good to know. And then mammograms start now at what age? Is it younger or is it 40?
It's 40. Well, you're going to hear conflicting things.
Okay.
So some people say 40, some people say 50, some people say every year, some people say every other year.
Okay.
But kind of differently from cervical cancer, the data coming out now is saying that if you start at 40 and you get a mammogram every year, you're way less likely to develop. We're catching more breast cancer and early breast cancer that doesn't require as invasive treatment. So I was recommending it at age 40 every year.
Yeah.
But then if you don't have any risk factors for breast cancer, sometimes patients will go every 2 years, which is fine.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of a rule follower. I've always been the one, like when we were growing up, it was, you go every year, mm-hmm, and then as soon as they said start doing mammograms, because I feel like prevention is everything. And
it absolutely,
like, if
is.
I can just prevent, then I feel like I'm going to be okay. But if I don't go for several years, I get a little, you know, you get a little nervous. But what questions do you have, Christy?
Well, we're talking about all the ways you can be active in your medical care And I know this is going to open a can of worms, but not everyone has access.
You're so right.
Yeah. You know, we have so many women that just don't have the access. What are their options?
So there are some, they're coming out with some online clinics, but it kind of depends on why they don't have access. So if they don't have health insurance, that's really, really tough. And that is when it comes down to being so state specific. So there, in a lot of states, there are good cancer prevention programs. So like to cover cervical cancer screening, so pap smears and mammograms. But as you know, when there's so much more women's health than preventing cancer, like menopause management, I mean, again, it's another can of worms we could always talk about, but it's tough. So without access to good quality healthcare, I think there are some online resources and like seeking out people in your community who maybe can offer advice and wisdom from their experiences.
And
but
connect you maybe.
Yeah.
To a resource.
Yeah. But it's tough. And I think getting like, if you move to a new area and you're like, okay, I don't have a primary care provider, finding one as soon as possible, because you may not be able to see them for 6 to 9 months. So it does take a bit of work on your part to like seek out and knowing that you may not be able to find it for a while, but it's hard. It's really hard in places where people are under uninsured.
Yeah.
You know, you and I were having a discussion the other night and you said the word medical literacy.
Yes.
Tell us more about that. What do you mean by that?
So health literacy is the ability just to understand what is happening to your body and to have a basic knowledge about your health and wellness. And so if we're talking about things like sex ed, for example, that is like a great way to build the basis of health literacy when it comes to reproductive health. And a lot of people, you know, they don't feel comfortable talking about their bodies. They don't feel comfortable listening to information about their bodies. And I think a lot of it is the taboo around our bodies and knowing ourselves.
Yeah. Which is crazy to me.
Right?
That people still have that. Like, that seems so foreign to me.
Me too. But it happens all the time. And people not understanding, like, I have had plenty of patients who don't know that you don't pee out of your vagina. I mean it. And not having a basic understanding of their own anatomy. And it's not their fault. Yeah. It comes back to how we're being taught and how we're talking about our bodies. And I think just having a basic understanding, and that's kind of what I mentioned earlier, a good place to start with your own health literacy is knowing what your body looks like. And not just, you know, your sexual organs, reproductive organs, but like knowing what that mole on your back looks like.
Yeah.
And that way you know that, oh, you know, this changes, because we're talking about like skin cancer is another important thing. We're talking about health prevention.
Yeah.
And knowing what you look like and knowing what parts of you are things you need to keep an eye on.
Yeah.
That's the first place to start with health literacy, I think, is knowing yourself and knowing your body and your anatomy. And then kind of going from there, like we're talking about when it comes to health literacy, understanding the menstrual cycle and understanding what it means when your period is late, or like what it means to be ovulating in the context of trying to prevent pregnancy. That all comes back to health literacy and understanding about these things about yourself and about the way your body works.
Yeah.
And knowing like how to access healthcare systems is a huge part of health literacy too.
Yeah.
Excuse me, because how many people don't even know how to make a doctor's appointment?
That's true.
You know?
That seems so crazy, but Christy, you had that's a really good point. There are two more topics I want to bring up that just kind of hit me. That are not fun topics.
Let's get into it.
But it's all about the bladder.
Oh, yeah.
Because I want to talk about UTIs in older women and like premenopause, postmenopause. And then I want to talk about bladder control and what happens.
Got it.
Those are two frustrating areas.
Like, yep, they are.
So UTIs, I know, happen to any age, but they tend to be more dangerous, I guess, as you start getting more. Because then you're looking at some. Talk to us a little bit about that.
So,
and how to maybe prevent UTIs.
If I can, especially if we're talking about people who are perimenopausal to menopausal, if they can take one thing away from this podcast, is please ask your provider about vaginal estrogen. Okay. Because vaginal estrogen decreases the risk of urinary tract infections. It decreases the risk of skin cancers in the vulva.
Oh.
And it can increase physical comfort. Even if you're not sexually active, vaginal dryness is uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But if you are sexually active, lube is not often enough, because when you go through menopause, if you're not on systemic hormone medication, then you don't have estrogen in the vaginal and the vulvar and the tissue and the urethra, which means that that tissue becomes less stretchy.
Oh.
It becomes drier. And when you'd have hypoestrogenic urethras,
you're more prone to, because the, we kind of talk back about those healthy bacteria.
Yeah.
They live in an estrogen high state. So if you don't have estrogen, then the good bacteria aren't there to fight off pathogens. So people get something called atrophic vaginitis, which is a vaginal infection.
Okay.
Just because you don't have estrogen.
Right.
And then you're more likely to have urinary tract infections and even urinary incontinence. Like, we talked, well, there are different kinds of urinary incontinence.
Yeah. So
stress urinary incontinence, which is when you pee yourself, if you laugh, cough, sneeze, that can decrease the vaginal estrogen. And especially in people who are, you know, like starting to lose, I guess, I don't know what the, like, cognitive clarity. So, you know, people who are much older, when they get urinary tract infections, they're not able to recognize it because they're not, they don't have as much cognitive clarity.
Got it.
They can lead to sepsis, which can lead to delirium, which can lead to, you know, it's kind of like a snowball effect.
I know. It happened to somebody I know, and I was blown away by it. I had no idea.
Just because of a UTI. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. That's crazy.
So even if you're not postmenopausal, you can still, if you're having signs of atrophy, you can have vaginal estrogen. A lot of people are concerned, and a lot of providers will tell you this, that, oh, you shouldn't be on estrogen. It can increase your risk of blood clots. That is systemic estrogen, and it can increase your risk of blood clots. However, it's such a lower dose compared to like a birth control pill. And if you start it, if you start hormones when you kind of first hit menopause, then it's less likely to have that kind of blood clot effect. That's a menopause conversation. We're talking about bladders.
Yeah.
So vaginal estrogen, even if you don't want to be on systemic hormones, it's not absorbed systemically for the most part. So there may be maybe like less than 1% is absorbed systemically. It really just acts on that tissue to bring blood flow back, to help promote those healthy pathogens, healthy bacteria that fight pathogens. And it will change people's lives if people are, you know. So that is the solution to a lot of recurrent UTIs in women.
Okay, so Chrissy and I, we're lucky enough that we are doing the hormones, which I think is helping a lot. We've been able to have access to the hormones, which has been a game changer. I have really, going through menopause has been awesome. But we still have, you know, you still have the bladder stuff. But is the rule of thumb still like after you have sex, go to the bathroom?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, still.
And before.
And before.
You can. I mean, some people are like, oh, if I go before, I can't go after. Well, prioritize peeing after. But that, the reason for that is because when you have...
Even if you're your age, you can go before and after.
Yeah.
That's right.
But just because it literally, like, you know, the in the act of, like, when you're having sex, there's a lot of rubbing and bumping.
Yeah.
And it, you know, the act of sex literally can push bacteria into the urethra, which if, when you pee, it just clears it out.
Yeah.
So, yes, I always pee after sex every time, even if it's like not penetrative intercourse. So if it's like oral sex, still after, pee every time. And vaginal estrogen. Even if you're on systemic hormones, sometimes you still need vaginal estrogen.
Yeah.
Because, again, the doses are so low and it's so safe.
Yeah.
Now, is it fun to put, you know, a cream inside your vagina, around your vagina every night? It starts every night and then they reduce it to 2-3 times a week. So it's like, you know, you just pick 2 nights
a week. Still a great option.
Yeah, yes.
I think it's a really great option.
Which significantly decreases the risk of UTIs.
Okay, good to know. And last thing is as people get older, there is a lot of, there's a couple of surgeries or that can help with the bladder, like to help control incontinence or whatever. Like if you're coughing, sneezing, which I'm that candidate for sure.
Yes. That's called stress urge incontinence. So like stress incontinence is what that's called.
What do they do? What is the operation? Do you know what it is?
I don't totally know. Okay. But what a lot of what happens is that, and this happens if you have like childbirth is kind of one of the main causes, and then just like with time the way your body changes. But you know, you have your pelvic floor, which I can also not talk enough about your pelvic floor, but your pelvic floor supports your organs. So, well, they won't be able to see this, but I'm doing a visual with my hands here. But if this is your pelvic floor, and it's, you have your urethra, your vagina, and the anus, it's like this net of muscles, and they go between your organs.
Okay.
And so this net of muscles can get really relaxed and really loose, basically. Yeah. And they can't support your organs as well anymore.
Yeah.
And so when you have a weak pelvic floor, which can happen from childbirth and for all sorts of things, your bladder isn't supported anymore. And so then the muscles, the detrusor muscle that supports the bladder, isn't as effective at keeping like this, the sphincter, which is the, you know, the little like clasp between your urethra and your bladder. It's not as supported by those muscles. So it is a little more open. So then when you have the inner abdominal pressure of a laugh, cough, sneeze, because that sphincter isn't as open, or it's a little more open, I mean, that's when you,
you pass urine.
Okay.
So pelvic floor physical therapy is a great option for anybody. It's hard to access. Talking about access. But there also are like, are even YouTube videos. But pelvic floor physical therapy is one of the best things you can do if you're not going to get surgeries.
Yeah.
So my understanding of surgeries is that what they do is they put in mechanisms to literally lift the bladder because exactly.
I had it done.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So when your muscles aren't supporting the bladder, then you need something to mechanically support. Yeah. So that's what the mesh surgery does.
A game changer. It literally like changed my mental peace. It was physically just being able to like somewhere, going to the gym, everything. I had to be so like proactive with how I was going to navigate those experiences because of it. And it kind of like, it was daunting on me. And
talk about mental health.
It was. And I finally went and had the surgery and it worked really well for, I want to say maybe 2 years. Uh-huh. I probably need to redo it because it's now back, which I don't understand why, but it is.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, maybe we need to do
another episode.
Pelvic floor exercises, but no. Oh my gosh.
So when you think
I've already not jotted down YouTube pelvic floor exercises.
So, you know, one thing that's really helpful about actually seeing it, so people talk about Kegels. It's like everybody does Kegels, do your Kegels. But if they're not done correctly, they can be just as damaging as not doing them.
Really?
So that's why I think it's really beneficial to, if you can, to see a pelvic floor physical therapist, because they can give you literal feedback on, are you doing this exercise correctly?
Oh,
amazing. So, I didn't know that existed.
Yeah, they're huge. And you know, in countries like France, every single pregnant person gets a pelvic floor physical therapist because having babies can just destroy your pelvic floor, especially if it's bad vaginal birth, but even C-sections, like the weight of the pregnant uterus is just, so that's my other thought about that.
Okay. Well, oh my gosh, Christy, do you have, like, this has been so informative.
I think we covered some really great topics. I feel like we should probably have another episode, even if we have to do it on Zoom, because there's so much more we could talk about.
Yeah. I'm always down.
So much.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
But we covered a lot of ground.
We always like to end with a question.
Yes.
Do you want to ask her? I mean, she's still fairly young, but do you want to ask her? I mean, look at her. She's so brilliant.
Oh, thank you.
I love it. You know what? Just this has been so educational at 54, coming on 54, and learning so much. We appreciate you being here. We love to ask our guests, if you could tell your younger self, whether it's 12 to 16, that age range, what would you say to her?
Oh, gosh. That's an interesting one. I need to think about that for a second, but... Well, a lot of different things, first of all. First of all, that you don't need to flirt with boys as much as you think you do, because that's okay. That's not what your whole life needs to be about. I think I would also tell my younger self that your periods are too heavy and you need to talk to somebody about that. Especially now knowing what I know. Again, a whole other topic that we could talk about. And I also just think that it's going to... I think that's kind of it. I don't know what else I would tell. A lot, but also not a lot, because I think things worked out pretty well. So
That's good.
Yeah.
I love that.
That's good. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. This was so fun.
This was awesome. We learned so much. Thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
Thank you for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you think someone could benefit, please share. If there's a conversation you think we should be having or a topic that resonated with you, please let us know.
You can engage and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Pieces of a Woman Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform. If you listen to us on Apple, leave us a 5-star rating and a comment.